They have big transportation officers.
The Transportation Committee will come to order. We've got, six bills on the agenda today. First up is Senator Kubley, Senate File 2563. Senator Kubley, it's a land conveyance bill for tribal governments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill just pertains to a land swap, is what I'd call it, and I think you'd probably call it the same. But with me today is the tribal chair for Upper Sioux, Mr. Kevin. I know your last name, too. Well, anyway.
My name is Kevin Jensfeld. I'm the chairman of Upper Sioux Community, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you.
Is the microphone on?
Yeah, the mics are on. You just need to pull them closer to you there and turn up the internal volume a tad bit. So,
Again, I'll introduce myself. My name is Kevin Jensfeld. I'm the chairman of the Upper Sioux Community, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for having me here today. Thank you.
Just go ahead and explain.
The reason we're here, and I want to thank Senator Kubley.
Just a second, please. Can we lower the volume in the exterior there? Thank you. Please continue.
The reason we're here, and we have Senator Kubley proposing this amendment, is the tribe had proposed to relocate a intersection with State Highway 274 to be relocated to a proposed tribal road that currently sits on a county road in Yellow Medicine County. We had proposed to redo the road there for safety concerns, to move the intersection a little further away from Highway 23. All of this construction would be at tribal expense, and so we had went through the motions with MnDOT and local governments, and we had developed plans to do this, and along the way we discovered to move the intersection, the tribe was willing to give up right away to or convey to the state 4.3 acres of land to accomplish this. And our concern was that when we did that, we would have liked to have received the 4.3 acres that the state would be abandoning at that time. However, in looking at state law and through it was deemed by MnDOT that the commissioner could not convey to the tribe that land. It had to go through a process, and ultimately at the end the tribe could potentially purchase that from the state. And so at that point in time, I guess we kind of stepped back and we had looked for a legislative fix in this regard, because we do believe that it is a fair and equitable trade, and it does mitigate a safety concern, and also does address certain issues that we have at the intersection. And I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Our Vice Chairman, Travis Leonard, is in charge of our roads program, and he had a family emergency. He would be here to better clarify any questions you may have. But that's basically our dilemma at the moment, is we are willing to convey to the state 4 acres of right-of-way, and we would like to reacquire that right-of-way that the state would control, because it is surrounded by a tribal trust land, that right-of-way. So, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Members, council tells me that tribal governments are the only unit of government that are not part of this conveyance process. Senator Kubley, maybe somebody can tell me about the cost, but it seems like it's cheaper if we go with what you've proposed here overall for everybody involved.
Well, Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And there is no cost to the state. All costs will be covered by the tribal government if the committee is agreeable.
Senator Kubley, council tells me you need an effective date on this. So we'll, when at the appropriate time when we have a quorum, we'll put the effective date upon enactment, okay?
That'd
so
fine,
that it
Mr.
won't be August 1st. It'll be whenever the governor signs the bill.
That'd be fine, Mr. Chair.
Great. Well, what we're going to do right now is we don't have a quorum to take a vote. Let me see. One, two. No, we need...
Looks like you're getting close, Mr. Chair.
Got a couple more things.
Okay, well...
Gimsey was here and checked in.
Is Gimsey here? Number. Okay. Senator Moi moves Senate File 2563 as amended with the effective date to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate consent calendar. And that simply means that it's on the consent calendar to be voted and shipped right out. There's not going to be a lot of talk, no amendments or anything. This bill's ready to go is what it means. So, on the Moi motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Members, on the agenda, we're going to go from the bottom to the top. The bills that are 1, 2, and 3 are going to take a little bit longer, so we're going to get we're going to push some of these bills out. Oh, Senator Fischbach, you're up next, and then we'll do Senator Dibble's 1060 after that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know which order they appear, but I do have—I have two bills. One of them is really simple, and I thought maybe if we just took that one first, it would be easy.
All right, let's take that one, Senator Fischbach. Are you talking about 2572?
Yes, I believe so. It's the 5 days. Is that 2572? Yes, I'm getting a nod. Okay.
Okay, and Chris will pass out any information that you have.
Thank
there.
You. And Mr. Chair, members, this is simply it. It makes the 5 days that have to be notified when a car is impounded, it makes them essentially business days as opposed to 5 days. Because the constituent who brought this to my attention wrote a letter. He did address another issue in there, but the first paragraph he does address the issue of, you know, you impound a car on Friday and your 2 days are used up before it's even, you know, before a working day even starts, before a business day even starts. So I think this one is pretty self-explanatory, pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Fischbach, I would agree. This is just a, this is the way everybody does business, so we might as well. Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 2572 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate consent calendar.
Thank you.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Fischbach, now on your next bill.
And, Mr. Chair, this is Senate File 2571, and this one may be a little more complicated. If you would like me to explain a little bit of the bill, basically it would require the Commissioner of Transportation to relinquish or provide an easement for certain lands if they require, or excuse me, if they meet certain requirements that they're outside of the right-of-way, that the city or state or the governing body would apply, submit a request for that easement or relinquishment, and that the planned construction meets certain requirements of going from one parcel to another. And then finally, the exception could be made that MnDOT wouldn't be required to make this relinquishment if they could show with three cases or studies that it would be unsafe. And I do have this was brought to my attention by a constituent, and I do have a constituent with me, Mr. Klein, that he, I'm sure, would like to say a few words. And I brought along the mayor of Sartell, which is the city this piece of land sits in, to testify also.
Is it Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, senators, and members. My name is Frank Klein,
And for 5 years, I've been trying to develop our property at the junction of State Highway 15 and Benton County Road 29 in Sartell, Minnesota. The corner is controlled by a stoplight with left turn arrows. I've spent numerous hours and days monitoring the traffic flow and safety along this corridor. Excuse me. When I purchased the property, the access street was in and the lots were platted. My sons and I built an upscale retail center the very first year of our ownership, and some of the customers had brought to our attention that it was very awkward to get into the development. So since then, I've been approached by two major oil companies wanting to build gas station C-stores on that corner lot. They like the visibility and the traffic flow. However, they didn't go through with the purchase agreements because of the difficulty getting into the development. The access just isn't very favorable. Culver's Restaurants have also contacted us looking at another lot in this development. They, too, decided to move on because of the poor access. I contacted the city of Sartell to see what could be done in developing a turn lane into the development. I was informed by the city that I should set up a meeting with the local MnDOT office in St. Cloud. But in the meantime, I had contacted an engineering firm to lay out a diagram and a proposed site-specific right turn lane only into this development. I then met with Mark Wren, who's the roadway regulation supervisor for MnDOT in the St. Cloud office. I explained my situation and informed him that I would be willing to pay and cover all the expenses for the right turn lane, and I would even reimburse the state for the easement rights that they had purchased from the Pogansky family a couple decades earlier. Mark Wren listened to my plea and then informed me that it probably wouldn't happen, but he would present it to his board. 2 days later, I received an email from Mr. Wren stating that we must continue using the access that was constructed in 1995. I then contacted Representative Dan Severson. He met me at the site, listened to my concerns, and he totally understood my problem and informed me that he would set up a special meeting with the St. Cloud MnDOT office. The meeting was attended by Mark Wren and Jim Povich of the St. Cloud MnDOT office, Sartell Mayor O'Driscoll, Councilman Pat Lynch, Representative Severson, and myself. All of us took turns explaining our position regarding this right turn lane and discussed safety issues, which were overcome one by one at the time. And the fact that I wasn't asking for anything that hasn't and isn't already being used, there are right turn lanes like the one I'm proposing all over the place in St. Cloud, Sartell. And I was wondering why other developers are able to use this sort of a right turn access when I'm denied it. And their response was basically that they own the easement rights, and that's just the way it was going to be. I also addressed the fact of safety concerns regarding getting emergency vehicles into the property if that one street were to become blocked off due to a natural disaster or even road work. And Mr. Wren said, well, I think they could just drive through the ditch. Now, this is our local roadway engineer. Now, the ditch is 6 feet deep and 12 feet wide and carries snow all winter long and water in most of the spring, summer, and fall. So getting any emergency vehicle through a ditch just isn't the answer. But Mr. Povich finally again stated that they own the easement rights, and that's just the way it was going to be. So I'm here today to ask for your help in trying to overcome this dilemma.
Thank you, Mr. Klein.
Questions, Mr. Klein?
Mr. Klein, I do have a question.
When you acquired this property, was there any access to County Road 9 or to the State Trunk Highway, direct access, other than what appears to be some baggage road?
The only access into that development is a street on County Road 29, and it's approximately a quarter mile from the stoplights, the junction of 29 and Highway 15. And that roadway comes around the back part of the property, making it pretty awkward to get in. There are three buildings in there right now, and the three main highway lots just fail to get developed because of that awkward access.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Fischbach.
You may be looking at the map.
Mm-hmm.
The access is over here. It doesn't show on the map. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Mayor, do you want to make some comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the city of Sartell was approached by Mr. Klein about opportunities to develop this property. And as Mr. Klein outlined, it's near Minnesota Highway 15, Benton County 29, and it's probably about three-quarters of a mile from U.S. Highway 10. So it is in a relatively rural area where the property exists, although there is high volume of traffic that can come down Minnesota 15 and U.S. 10 at different times of the year, some of it being seasonal traffic. Mr. Klein's hope and intention was to be able to acquire the ability to develop that area. He does have a partial development in that area. However, as he stated, he's losing out on opportunities to be able to further develop that property. The city of Sartell is not taking a position one way or the other as to whether or not this should be adopted. Mm-hmm. We would like to also have clarification, though, of the process that MnDOT's going to undergo. We have individuals, not exclusively Mr. Klein, but others who have come to us and said, here is an example in a community where it's coming off of a Minnesota highway where this type of a right turn was granted, but here we have a right turn that's coming off of a Minnesota highway onto a county road onto private property. Where's the disparity? Where's the rationale? And so the city of Sartell is interested in seeking clarification on this because we're kind of in the catch-22. We've got the developer who owns property in the community who comes to us and says we'd like to develop this, we'd like to put jobs in the area, we'd like to increase the tax base in the area. But on the other hand, we are grappling with the issues of public safety, which we are very keen and in tune with as well. Another person that I brought along who works on this with a daily on these matters on a daily basis with us in the city of Sartell is our planner, and I'd like to have her maybe give some more background as to her experiences with this particular parcel and mm-hmm. some of the experiences that she's had not only in her employ in the city of Sartell, but she's worked in other jurisdictions as well. So, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to introduce Anita Rasmussen, the Planning Community Development Director for the city of Sartell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As the mayor has stated, I am aware of this property. And
Ms. Rasmussen, can you say your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm Thank sorry. You. Anita Rasmussen, mm-hmm. Planning and Community Development Director with the City of Sartell. We have been approached, the city, both myself and the city engineer to a certain extent, regarding the dilemma along County Road 29, in particular with this property owner, Mr. Klein. We, as staff, working for a local government, clearly understand the need and the desire and the requirement for ordinances and rules and regulations. But we also have empathy for property owners when they want rationale behind those rules and regulations and laws. And so what we're seeking is just some idea as to why it's allowed in some areas, why it's not allowed in others. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I think we owe it to constituents and we owe it to property owners those questions to be answered. As the mayor has stated, we're neither for or against this particular, but what we are seeking is consistency in the application. Our ultimate goal is for the property owner and the businesses in that corridor to succeed, and we want to be able to exhaust all opportunities for those property owners to succeed. If because of public safety issues or access issues this doesn't work here, that's okay, but at least we have some rationale and reasoning behind it, and I think that's what we're looking for and that's what we're wanting to hope to achieve.
Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen. Are there Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess to that point, maybe a question for Senator Fischbach is that I'm looking down on subdivision 2, the exception, those instances when the commissioner may deny such a request, and you're looking for three cases or studies of comparable traffic engineering situations, et cetera. Is that where you're looking for substantive rationale for this decision, or can you tell me more why the magic number is three?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, three may be a bit arbitrary, but what we are looking for here is some real solid information that this would be a danger or somehow, you know, unsafe to put this in. You know, three could be two, possibly. But I would think that, you know, more than one would be necessary in order to establish, because we're talking about similar roadways in other parts of the state, so there would be some variance there. So I'm sure that they want something. You know, we're looking for something that would actually establish an unsafe.
Thank you.
Further questions for Senator Fischbach or her constituents? Is there anybody here in opposition to Senate File 2571? Sir, please come to the table.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Are we going to hear from MnDOT at all on this?
That's who we're going to hear from right now.
There they are. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Polvich. I'm the Assistant District Engineer for MnDOT in District 3, the St. Cloud office, and the alleged bad guy in all of this, I guess you might say. I'm actually a resident of Sartell, so I probably drive through this intersection several times a week, and it's actually only a few miles from our office. I've got 40 years of experience in traffic engineering, and I only mention that because I have not always worked for MnDOT. Earlier in my career, I was a private consultant, and I worked for property owners and private developers in their efforts to get access to the public roadway system. So as I told Mr. Klein when we met, I try to bring an open mind and kind of a unique perspective to these things, because I've sat on both sides of the table on this, and regardless of what side of the table I was on, I always applied the same safety principles to what I was trying to do. Let me just briefly talk about this instance here in Sartell, which I think is obviously behind the broader legislation here. This intersection is a major signalized intersection in Sartell in the St. Cloud area. There's about 30,000 vehicles a day that go through this intersection, which is a lot. About 12 years ago, because of the rising number of crashes and of attempts.
Excuse me just a second. Somebody at the table here has a BlackBerry on, so if you got it on, turn it off, and then we'll quit getting the feedback on our equipment. Maybe it's mine.
It went away, Steve.
Oops. Excuse me while I gavel myself out of the way. Please, Mr. Polvich.
What I was about to say is about 12 years ago, in response to a rising number of crashes and a fatality at this intersection, we did an improvement project there, which we installed a traffic signal and turn lanes, and we had access control. And we also built the backage road, which was referred to provide access to this property. And I know there was a statement made that, you know, this is different. I guess I would ask you, and none of you probably live in the St. Cloud area, but I would ask you to drive up and down Highway 15, and you will find that every intersection along Highway 15 has the same type of design, the same type of access control as this one. Matter of fact, some intersections are even more restrictive than the one that we have here. There was some reference made to the process used in our district on these things. Let me just briefly tell you what we do. Whenever somebody in our district, it's a 12-county area, whenever somebody who has property along our state highway system comes in and wants a driveway, they fill out an entrance permit. We have a committee that's made up of real estate people and safety people, about a dozen of them, and they meet monthly, and they review each and every access request, and the vast majority of those are approved because they can be done safely. In this case, it couldn't, and it was denied for public safety reasons. I should also mention, you know, because, again, I'm in my conversations with the property owner, I'm kind of the bad guy in this, but I have discussed this with the county engineer, and I have discussed this with the elected official, the county commissioner who represents that area, and neither one of them are in favor of this access either for safety reasons. As was mentioned, I did meet with Mr. Klein, the property owner, and some other folks a couple of months ago. And one of my first questions to Mr. Klein was, when you purchased this property, did you know that there was access control along County Road 29? He said, yes. I said, did you know what that meant? He says, yes, that means I don't get any driveways there. So he knew that prior to purchasing the property. If I can just do one last thing here, and that is I brought along a copy of an article from the Institute of Transportation Engineers Journal. It's a monthly publication, and this is kind of the Bible for traffic engineers around the world. And it's titled Effects and Impacts of Access Management. And could I have just, is it okay to take just a couple of minutes to summarize this article?
Sure.
Okay. This article goes on to say, access management does involve trade-offs between the often competing objectives of maintaining mobility and providing access to abutting properties, which is the situation we have here. Those attempting to implement access management may be called upon to justify access management and discuss the expected effects, not only on the traveling public, but also on abutting property and businesses. Fortunately, one does not have to rely on speculation or unsubstantiated claims to estimate the effects of access management. Research studies have been conducted to compare roadways that have access management with roadways that do not. Studies have shown that access management, the systematic control of the location, spacing, design, and operation of driveways, median openings, interchanges, and street connections to a roadway, improves the safety and mobility of the roadway. And then just one last paragraph here on the closing. Access management is critically important along roadways that are expected not only to accommodate the safe and efficient movement of through traffic, but also to provide access to adjacent properties. The wide-ranging benefits of access management extend to a host of users and affected parties. These and other access management design features can be expected to produce the following benefits. Improve the roadway safety by controlling some of the factors that contribute to roadway crashes. Enhance mobility by reducing impediments to smooth traffic flow. Protect the public investment in the roadway system by greatly extending the functional life of arterials to move people and goods. Reduce emissions and fuel consumption due to improved traffic flow and create a more attractive transportation corridor. Mm-hmm. So again, this is basically the Bible that all traffic engineers go by. I've always learned that access management is the number one thing that you can do to enhance safety along a roadway. It by far gives you better benefits than installing traffic signals, guardrail, or four-lane highways. Access management is the most important thing you can do. I guess one last comment, you know, the question about putting in this access, it would not meet any of the design standards that anybody currently uses, whether it's the state, county, or city. Mm-hmm. It's not far enough away from this major signalized intersection to even put in a standard right turn lane. So anyway, maybe I'll conclude my comments with that. I talked about the process that we used and the reasons why we denied this.
Senator John Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess to Mr. Is it Povich?
Povich.
Povich. A couple questions. First, speed limit in that area at this intersection, do you know?
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I'm going to guess it's probably around 30 miles an hour, maybe slightly above it. I don't know if anybody in the city knows. 40? It's 40 miles per hour.
Okay. And my eyes are getting kind of old, members, so it looks like this is 196 feet.
That sounds about right. From the intersection?
So, yeah. Mr. Povich, this is basically talked about as a conflict point, and
yes,
at a certain speed limit, how much reaction time would somebody have coming through the intersection for somebody making a right turn at that point?
A typical length for a turn lane and the taper to get to the turn lane on a 30-mile-per-hour roadway would be 480 feet. So you've got slightly less than 200. Yeah, I just found out I was coming here yesterday, so I mean, I've got a crude diagram for you if you want to see the conflict points that would arise by putting this in, if that would help you in your discussions on this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Povich. And I guess, members, I just like to understand these things. These do become issues in a lot of cities and counties and in terms of access points for business and economic development. So it's it is kind of a fine line in understanding, is the conflict potentially created? Do you get more of a benefit out of the economic development and things? And I don't know why I always go back to Andover, Minnesota. We have these things where, in point of fact, the city creates like 128 conflict points on one side of the intersection, and they won't allow the businesses on the other side of the intersection to create the same type of a conflict point. So I think that's what we're kind of talking about, Mr. Povich. So when we're thinking through those things, I think that's the kind of information we need to deal with this, because really developers and we just want the same kind of access. I guess I shouldn't say we. I'm not. I used to own a real estate and developing company. So if it's common in this area, I can see the argument, but if it's not, then it's not good practice. I understand that from an engineering standpoint, from a safety standpoint, but I think these things start that way, where everybody wants to be treated with an equal footing, and so we need to kind of understand around the state what kind of footing is in the area. And you, if you just found out about this, you probably can't give us any information on that, if that exists in other places around this particular intersection or area. Maybe the mayor could help us or something.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, again, as I said earlier, if you go up and down the Highway 15 corridor in the St. Cloud area, you'll see basically the exact design at every intersection. There are no intersections with driveways close to the traffic signals. Matter of fact, you know, you mentioned treat yourself like others or so. I mean, our office is on Highway 15 in St. Cloud. And I would have to guess our driveway to the city street that we come out on is probably 1,000 feet from Highway 15.
That's not true. Mr. Chair,
Senator Fischbach
was going to try to address Senator Jungbauer's question.
Mr. Chair, as I had mentioned earlier, I had driven around the area, and not for argumentative sake, but Mr. Povich states that there aren't any along Highway 15, when in reality they are. There's several turnoffs on 3rd Street, which is a heavily congested corner, which is one of the main arteries into Crossroads Shopping Center. And they have right turn areas into different various buildings there that are approximately 250 feet. I stated to the at that meeting in St. Cloud that there are new developments that have accesses that are under 200 feet. And when I presented that information to Mr. Povich, he said, well, we didn't have the access rights to that area, so that's why they were allowed to do it. So there definitely are examples out there. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'm looking to do, and some of you might be thinking, well, this developer just wants to develop this property and make a ton of money. That, you know, I'm in business to make money, granted, but this is strictly hindering the development of that area. We have major businesses that want to build in there. We're talking about a $10 million economic growth to that area. We're asking that, we're expecting 100 jobs to be created after the buildings are put up, and over 100 jobs to build the buildings. So this is a huge economic development for Benton County and the city of Sartell. And all of us are in favor of keeping safety in mind. And as I mentioned earlier, without seeing that intersection, it's hard to imagine the stoplights and being controlled with left turn arrows. The only direction that would allow for any little fender benders as if the traffic was coming across the intersection from the east heading west. And then there would be the right turn lane, which I feel is sufficient enough for a car to go into that right turn lane and make that exit. And Mr. Povich and I had talked about this at our last meeting. And he said, well, it probably wouldn't be a fatal accident, but it'll be a fender bender. Well, we have fender benders all over the place, no matter what. Thank
you. Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Mr. Klein. And, Mr. Klein, we're normally not in the business of allowing something to
happen that is going to create a disturbance on our road, even if there are other disturbances out there. And you mentioned some of those others on Highway 15. But, you know, this bill has statewide implications, not just the implications at the intersection there at Highway 15 and County 29. You know, so we have to consider that as well. I mean, you know, if you got a fire going, you don't put it out by throwing gas on it.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if that's what I was going to say.
I really feel that this would throw gas on a situation that could get out of control in a hurry.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for whoever can answer this. And I guess I always look at stuff, too. Are we creating a new exception that you know, does cause some safety issues long-term on as I'm looking at this particular item, because, you know, I'm always trying to find that balance between development, economic development, safety, and those sorts of things. On County Road 29, is that hard channelization in the center?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Senator, are you asking, is that raised channelization? It is a raised median in the
raised
center
median
of the
hard channelization.
Yeah.
Okay. So you wouldn't be having people crossing over trying to get in at the last minute either, so it's... I don't know what the answer is, Mr. Chair, but I'm always thinking that, especially in my district, we go through a lot of these things where there's a, you know, how do we balance what's good economically for a neighborhood, a city, with the safety issues. So I'm just trying to make sure we're looking at the whole picture here.
No, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Mr.
Fishbach.
I understand the statewide implications of the bill, and obviously we're talking about one specific issue that we are very concerned about and trying to find a way to address it so that the economic development could be continued. I would be willing – I got the impression after Mr. Povich's testimony, though, that they're unwilling to you know, look at this specifically and help or try to come up with possibly a different way to handle it, anything. I don't know if you're shutting the door or not, because I would be willing to go back and try to address this specifically because I understand the statewide implications of the bill. I don't know if I can count on you for that. If that was something you'd be interested in, we could potentially lay the bill over or lay it on the table.
Senator Fishbach, that's probably the direction that you'd want to go. I think that there is...
Well, Mr. Chair, I would actually... I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Chair. Of course, I would never interrupt you, but because I know the power of the transportation chair.
Why not? Chair. Everybody else has.
And, and I don't want to be rude, but I would... If we're going to go that route, I would like to get some something from Mr. Povich saying that he's going to work on this and we're not just going to shut this down, that we need to have some continued discussion and something to address this issue in particular.
Yeah.
That's before we went that direction.
Well, Senator Fishbach, and that's kind of what I was going to suggest, but, you know, since this does have a statewide implication, I'd ask that you work with not only Mr. Povich, but... you know, with some of the other MnDOT folks, because, you know, down in District 6 where I'm from, we have these too, and I'm sure they have them in Carlson's district and Olson's and Scoy. So we want to make sure that if we're going to have a standard policy for access points on state trunk highways or the ones that we have jurisdiction over, that we want to make sure that it's right. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am familiar with this. I have driven this quite a bit, actually. How would the traffic get back onto 15? I mean, how does the traffic get back out of the site?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, they would have to funnel out the entrance that's existing right now. So this would be a right turn lane only. So once they got into the development, they would take 14th Street East out.
And so they end up coming out to the north?
They would be coming out to the west on Benton County Road 29.
29 and then going back.
And then they could take a left-hand turn to get back to Highway 15 if that's their direction.
And improving the access at that point doesn't help you?
Really not, because what it is, it's, and I'm sorry for not bringing a better diagram of the existing entrance, but 14th Avenue East comes in behind the entire development, and to get into the various lots, they have to turn off on secondary streets. So there could be, like in a case with the gas stations, they have what's called a two-turn rule. They like their customers to make only two turns to get into the gas station. Otherwise, they feel that 80% of their customers will bypass them to go to a more convenient station. So instead of two turns, they would be forced to make five turns to get into that corner lot.
But they still would have to make the same five turns getting back out.
They would have to make four turns coming out. But they said coming out isn't the issue. Their big concern is to get them in.
Thank you.
We have just one further statement. We have a oil company that is prepared to go forward with this if a right turn lane was worked out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, did you have a question? Or?
Mr. Chair, you were kind of going down the path that I was thinking about.
Okay.
Well,
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Povich, before we get a commitment on your part to work with this, is this site have other access points that could be developed for this property, or is the safety issue concerned for the whole corner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if you're familiar with the site, it's one side of it is bordered by Highway 15, which is a four-lane expressway, and basically doesn't have any access to it all the way through the St. Cloud area except for the major public streets that intersect it and are signalized. The other roadway is just County Road 29 on the other part of the site, and that's the only public roadways that border this.
My question was, is there another option for access to this property besides this one? Legitimately, Senator Fischbach has asked you to work with him on it. I don't know if there's a possibility of changing that to really working with him to find a site, or if it's just impossible in this particular site safely.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yeah, certainly. I mean, we're always open to working with anybody, and that's why I mentioned in my opening remarks, I mean, I wasn't always this state bureaucrat, you know, I was working for people like Mr. Klein for a good part of my career to help them determine what is good access to the highway. So, I mean, I do bring an open mind to this. This is a tough site to look at right now, though, given the highways that are bordering it and the restrictions that are on them. But the only thing we were asked to look at was this proposal that he had made. And I neglected to mention when I was describing our process that Mr. Klein also did avail himself our state ombudsman's office, something that Commissioner Sorrell has instituted, kind of an independent look at the situation. And so he did take advantage of that, and our ombudsman's office reached the same conclusion that we had reached. But he went through that process anyway. But, yeah, certainly we're open to looking at whatever here. But, again, it's not going to be an easy thing to grant more access in this area.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, I think to answer your question more specifically, there really isn't another area to have an access to that property because what Mr. Povich said, because of State Highway 15, Benton County Road 29, the neighboring property is owned by another development company that really has not developed it, and they're to the west of us, and then there's a lot of swampland around there. And I had talked to the county regarding that, and there really isn't any other access. If there was, I would be more than glad and willing to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, would something like this be, could this become like a test site? I'm just trying to think ahead. If this could be an issue throughout the entire state for different areas, could a right turn lane like this into this type of development be looked at as a site that we could be facilitated and looked at over a period of years as a test to see something like this happen?
I know what you're saying, Senator Perry, but you know, there's a couple different standards when it comes to building highways, and MnDOT has a pretty high standard. You know, there's also the AASHTO standards, and I'm just kind of looking at this and just a little bit about I know about the AASHTO standards, which are
looser than what we play by here in the state of Minnesota. It doesn't even meet those requirements. I think putting a test in a place that we know we're going to have issues is going to cause more issues. And if there's a way that Senator Fischbach and the mayor and everyone can kind of work on maybe some other mechanism to make access available to this corner, I think that that would be a better solution. I kind of agree with MnDOT that this is a little tight here. And even Mr. Klein, you know, you're talking about bringing in 100 jobs here. And if those 100 people all got to be at work at the same time, there's not much to stack in lane in 200 feet. I mean, and, you know, you got people coming down the county road. And I can see how there could be some safety concerns here that I don't think a design is going to address in this small area. Maybe, you know, 400 feet down the road or, you know, granted it's right from the corner. It's like another 1,300 feet to the next, you know, right off of that road. Maybe there's a place that's 500 feet down the road that would work better. I don't know what kind of businesses or what kind of developments along there. But, you know, to do something on a statewide basis that would have this kind of ramification would be, well, we've been pretty responsible as a committee, and I think that would go against that. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to – I don't know how remote or how near other development this is, but I'm just curious to know if everyone coming to the site is coming in a car or motorized vehicle, or any little kids coming to this area on a bike, or anyone coming by foot. I just ask because I don't see any consideration
Mr. Chair,
for that
Senator,
in this configuration.
What's in there right now, there's a psychology center, there's a vacant building that was a veterinarian clinic, and then our retail center. So we have, you know, 90% of the vehicles coming in there are cars. We don't have any bicycle traffic at this point.
Okay, well, just if we do kick this down the path a little bit and you're having these conversations, just to keep that in mind.
Thank you, Senator.
One idea.
Senator Jungbauer says he has an excellent idea for you, so please see him after the committee hearing.
Well, and Mr. Chair, maybe on that note, I will move to lay this on the table, and we will go ahead and continue discussions
okay.
if we can come up with a different solution. But I'll move to lay it on the table for now.
Oh, well, thank you, Senator Fischbach. Senator Fischbach has moved that Senate File 2571 be laid on the table. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Senator Dibble.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fischbach. Senator Dibble, you have an amendment for your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is Senate File 1060, and I have the A2 amendment, which is a delete all amendment.
Okay, if we can get that, all right. Chris is on it. He's passing that out as we speak. Since this is your this is the first stop for this bill, is that correct?
Yes,
Senator Dibble moves the A2 delete all amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Dibble on the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And just to kind of preview how we hope to handle this particular bill, I'd like to present it, give a high-level overview for each of the ideas that are in the bill, and then lay it on the table, because it's kind of a big bill with a lot of ideas, and we may not have gotten everything completely right. And I think we'll have an opportunity then for those who are interested in further work on the bill to work on it, and then we'll come back. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you intend to compile an omnibus policy bill. If so, you might move that forward in that fashion. So, Mr. Chair and members, with that, Senate File 1060, like I said, is a compilation of ideas that have percolated up in recent years through a variety of means. Certainly we have had some examination of MnDOT and our transportation program in the aftermath, of course, of the bridge collapse as a result of the transportation bill that we passed a couple of years ago. We had a couple of task forces go off and meet and talk about some ideas. So there are some thoughts that we benefit from there. And then just some experiences we've had in debating various issues that have confronted this committee over the last few years. And so that's kind of where these come from. We kind of packaged them all together and put them in this bill for consideration. And also just to say from the outset, MnDOT has had a chance to review a lot of this and have raised no significant objections, have provided a number of critiques that we've incorporated into this delete all. And my intention is to pass this either with MnDOT support or at least in the absence of their objection, as well as other stakeholder groups. At least one other group has approached me today with some thoughts and some ideas as well. So I'll just launch right into it and run through the sections very quickly here. The first section one has to do with the research program at MnDOT, and of course we know that a certain percentage of MnDOT's appropriation is devoted specifically to research, and this would encourage the commissioner to use some of those funds for research into implementation of and innovations in bridge monitoring technology, and I think we're also supposed to get some. Research into an implementation of innovations in bridge monitoring technology, bridge inspections, best practices, cost effectiveness, et cetera. Moving on to section two, this has to do with, of course, our county state aid and our municipal state aid program. And that just simply asks that before we release those state dollars that we're spending on local roads, that what those funds are going to be spent on has a supporting rationale in the form of a logical plan of key priorities, strategic goals that these local authorities have developed, and what those criteria are that support those goals, performance targets and measures that they're going to use in developing those plans. Of course, we had a lot of discussion when we were having a lot of conversation about bridges. Most of the bridges in the state, of course, are local bridges, and we want to be sure that we're paying close attention to the fracture-critical bridges, the bridges that pose significant safety problems. And then item four, paragraph four, is kind of a look back to see what, in fact, we did. We released those dollars and then report back what, in fact, did we spend those dollars on. And then the remainder of that section is just about reporting back to the legislature. Section three. Section 3, really what we're trying to accomplish there, this was around that whole issue of the Federal Highway Administration not communicating very effectively to MnDOT some significant circumstances, some issues, some changes to the bridge inspection program. So it's really trying to make sure that someone is responsible for regular review of the literature, regular review of what's going on out in the larger world, what's going on with changes to the federal bridge inspection program. So it just asked through the mechanism of reporting back to the legislature what exactly is the bridge inspection quality assurance program and what changes have been made. I might note, I haven't noted all the changes that we made in this delete all amendment, but one of the changes that we responded to from MnDOT is we originally thought about doing this annually, and that's probably too frequent for that kind of activity because the changes just don't occur all that often. Section 4 is the debt financing management policy, this is a very simple request, and that is that we develop a debt finance management policy. There was some concern a number of years ago that we were actually going to go right into the red under some ideas that were being offered by others, and in fact our trunk highway fund was going to be in the red, and we were going to be highly leveraged. And so at that time, we talked about having a debt policy. How much debt are we going to carry in the trunk highway fund?
Scott, can you move the mic a little closer to you?
Sure.
Where?
So how much debt are we going to carry in the Trunk Highway Fund, whether that's, you know, outright bonding or that's federal advance funds or you name it. So what is the limit that we're going to place on the amount of debt in the Trunk Highway system? Which of those projects do we designate as eligible for debt? We're going to allocate and use those funds. What are our policies around debt service, repayment? How we're going to manage the fund balance. Again, that was a pending issue. And how we're going to deal with the risks, et cetera. And then, of course, we have a report back mechanism to the legislature. Moving on to Section 5. What Section 5 simply does is it brings into conformance the MnDOT goals section, this section, which deals with the commissioner and his duties and responsibilities. So it adds that safety, maintenance, preservation provision that we carry over in the larger agency goals and purposes. Section 6, again, the subject of a lot of conversation around these parts, in this committee in particular. That's making sure one of the, I think four or so positions at the leadership level of the agency is the chief engineer, and that chief engineer is a licensed professional engineer. Section 7 asks that we add a chapter to the statewide transportation plan, which, was just submitted. So we didn't want to ask for a complete revision to the state transportation plan, but add a chapter that really specifically and explicitly identifies what those performance targets are for measuring progress and achievement of our transportation system goals, objectives, and policies, and goes on to say that we really want those performance measures to be objective, verifiable, relating to cost estimates, district-to-district comparisons, et cetera. And then we also want to make sure we do have an opportunity to look back. What were those performance targets, and did we meet them, or did we fail to meet them? If we didn't, what does that tell us? What do we know about the failure to meet what we hoped to meet, and how is that going to inform our future actions and activities? I just wanted to say, if you haven't read the transportation policy plan, I know we've had a presentation on it, but I really encourage members to read it, because it really is an excellent document. It's outstanding work, mm-hmm. And it's really asking for a lot of this good work then to really be quantifiable, verifiable, objective, and really mm-hmm. inform in a way that we can account for the activities of the agency. Section 8 kind of is in that same spirit, and it allows the agency to appoint an employee to serve as the controller of the agency that would supervise the financial activities as well as the performance-based management, outcome-based management objectives that get set up in that transportation plan. And for those of you familiar with the concept of controller, that's kind of the party within the agency who is the honest broker, who can really deliver the information within the agency as well as to external stakeholders, including the legislature, that can really be relied on as objective, and gives us the ability to really examine agency efficiency. What did we say we were going to spend our money on, relative to the STIP and other documents, and did we, in fact, spend that money on those things? And if we didn't, why didn't we? And how does each project kind of cost out and really provide some of that analysis that we really need. Section 9, report on Department of Transportation Management changes. This is really just asking for a one-time report back to the legislature on a number of things that the agency, I think, has done and has had some interim reporting to this committee on stuff that has been articulated as things that the agency is going to do, and just kind of to wrap up that piece and get a one-time report about this time next year around particularly around the bridge management maintenance inspections program, how the bridge-related duties, decision-making, et cetera, articulating, really documenting, pinning down, because a lot of what we discovered in all of that conversation of a couple of years ago is much of what we do with respect particularly to the bridge maintenance and inspection program was really oral in nature, and so have we really nailed down how we carry out that function, districts relative to central, central relative to the districts, et cetera. And then, you know, how our budgeting process informs and weaves through that entire program. With respect, Mr. Chair, to the issues on the counties and the cities, you know, the release of those dollars being contingent upon an adopted plan and some rationale around criteria and performance goals. Bob Vanosik approached me with concerns from his organization, and I assured him that we're not moving on this bill today, so we'll have some time to work on that. He articulated they think they already do that through their five-year plan. I'm not sure that quite gets to what exactly we're trying to get at here, but the goal, and you'll see in the language as well, is to make something fairly simple, not onerous and burdensome, not create some sort of a new mandate that's going to cost anyone a bunch of trouble or money, and try to get to that through developing a kind of a standardized form that could be filled out, for example, easily reportable. But I do feel pretty strongly that we need to be sure before we release this money that it's supporting kind of our larger and widely held transportation plan goals. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, thank you for bringing this forward. It is very comprehensive. I like that it looks to put in a formal way data-driven decision-making and tries to provide for some structure of accountability. For example, I asked the question, you talk about having to set forward how things are prioritized. In my district, Plymouth will say that, you know, widening 494 from 394 all the way to the Fish Lake Interchange is the most important thing that could happen because every single day in rush hour, we are at a standstill. And I agree with them, and I question how come when we, you know, every year it doesn't seem to be on the plan. And so I wonder how those priorities are decided and where, you know, I assume it costs a certain amount of money. We may not have that money, but then how are projects put forward if we're saying congestion reduction is a goal? Well, then what are the things that we could do that would provide the most congestion reduction? So I think you're on the right track. I'd be curious to see how the department feels about the language in terms of if they feel as though it's too descriptive, too rigid. I don't know how they'd feel about it, but I like the approach. I think it's consistent with what the Wilder would say, looking at spending our dollars with return on investment in mind, and so I appreciate that. I thought, I thought there was probably a technical correction on page 4, line 4.23.
Yes, yeah, Senator Bonoff, that was going to be the motion. But
okay, good.
Let's fix that right now.
Okay. It's just you wouldn't want to say of every third 6 years thereafter.
Third should be stricken.
Yes.
So
Council says that third should be stricken. So on the Bonoff motion to strike.
That language, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. And then lastly, going to the section on controller, I'm a little uncomfortable with that because I would want to hear from the commissioner how he structures the agency. I know some organizations use a CFO, chief financial officer, some use a controller. They have a little bit different purview, and I don't know how the agency likes to structure that side, and I would be more for giving the commissioner of an agency the latitude to determine how they like to use their financial management and how they like to use their resources. So I would be more interested in having the objectives that we want accomplished set forward rather than the strategy to accomplish those objectives. Like, you should have a controller. I don't know if he wants or she wants a controller, but I do want to have a way to have the department report on a regular basis regarding financial measurement. So those would be my comments.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. Senator Dibble, my understanding was you're going to leave this bill in committee here for a little bit, so you can kind of flesh out some of these
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct, and those are those points are well taken. Mr. Chair, actually, while I'm thinking before I forget, I saw a little typo too. 4.30, I think the word measure should be plural, measures.
I'm sorry.
I don't know if we need to move that or just direction to staff to correct that.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion does prevail. Senator Rest, on this point, or?
Not on making us singular to the plural, but I have another issue. But go ahead.
Elash Rest, and then Senator Colt.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to Senator Bonoff. Thank you for the advice, and I took notes, and perhaps we will make particularly the controller piece permissive language and make the suggestion to the commissioner, and the commissioner can do with it as he sees fit.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I noticed a lot of things in here that it seems like we're already getting reports on. I'm just kind of, if you could give me an idea how much is already being done voluntarily by the commissioner and how much of it is new. Some of that is a little fuzzy to me. I think it's a good direction, but I'm just kind of curious as to how much they're already doing versus.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I don't think actually much of this is done, at least on a regular basis. I think a lot of this is pretty new. I mean, we have gotten, as the chair has initiated, reports from time to time. And certainly we've had, some of the, we have a performance-based system, and we hear from the responsible staff from time to time on that. But the main thrust of the bill is to really embed within the organization, kind of performance-based management, and to make sure that we're creating, in some fashion, a performance-based system that's accountable, that's verifiable, and that's regularly reported internally as well as to the relevant committees at the legislature.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also am struck by the section on the controller and just that function, whether it's a controller or whatever it is. And, one of the things that we take a really close look at in reports from the financial reports from the legislative auditor's office has to do with internal controls. Because that's where a lot of the integrity of an agency's financial management breaks down. And I hope that you would consider mentioning that at least here. I mean, they should have an internal audit group, but nevertheless that this controller or whoever is responsible for that function of controlling would also take on a special interest in the internal controls for the financial management of the agency. And then a more technical thing, I really do appreciate the way in which you have the reports structured. It would certainly pass muster in my committee in terms of giving the reports to the timing of them so that they're not January 1st because nobody's around,
right.
Or you give all that duty to for people during the last month of the year, which is often very difficult. And so February 1st is a good date, and that the reports are given to the chairs, not of specific committees, but chairs with jurisdiction over the policy and finance, and that the ranking minority members are also included as receivers of those reports. However, on line 625 to 626, I would suggest that you change the recipient there. When we say that preparing a summary of findings from a report for distribution and oral testimony to the legislature, where would that go? I mean, you throw it up in the air, and if it came down somewhere around here, that would be a report to the legislature. Often what happens is that if that shows up in statute, it's just delivered to the legislative reference library and just stays there. If you mean for every member of the legislature to receive that report, or maybe all members of the committees that deal with that, I think that would be a much better avenue of communication, so that the people that would really make use of the information and care about the information are the ones that get it. And then I really do like that you're asking the committees to hear directly in a committee hearing situation summaries of the report as well. But I would suggest that I don't know who you intend it for, but if it's all legislators or all legislators in particular committees, I would hope that you would be willing to specify that. I don't have I don't know who you mean to get it, so I don't have an amendment, but I hope that you'll come up with one.
Great. Thanks. We'll do that. Thanks. Appreciate the advice. And also we'll be I think also taking your cue and leadership over these last few years, I think we also talk about electronic submittal rather than
requiring. Yes, I appreciate that too. Yeah.
Senator Dibble, I know you're going to put this bill on the table, but you got another stop to make, so I wouldn't leave it sitting around very long. Senator Kolk.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, thanks. First question would be a fiscal note on this. Have you received one from the department?
Mr. Chair, there's a preliminary fiscal note, but it's not drawn to the amendment.
Right, there is not an official fiscal note yet.
Ms. Boyd want to describe her, Ms. Berezovsky?
Okay.
We took a section out. So that triggered some fiscal impact.
Okay. Well,
but then this controller section was put in, so that would create some fiscal impact potentially, unless the commissioner decided to use an existing employee.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So we'll look for that. I know we're laying this on the table, so we can look for that.
Ms. Boyd kind of did one kind of on the back of the cocktail napkin. It shows a little bit of cost here, but we're going to make sure that it's official before we turn the numbers loose, but the numbers are kind of small. So,
okay, thank you. And then my second question goes to Section 1, where you're getting fairly prescriptive on what you want to see with the bridge monitoring technology, whereas the former language was fairly open-ended and left a lot to the commissioner to make some decisions. On line 1.13, you say the commissioner shall give serious consideration to spending. With that word, what would serious consideration look like to you?
Seems
like a shall may sort of thing.
It's Mr. Chair. Yeah, point well taken. It's to of course continue to maintain the respect for the professional judgment of our commissioner, but to signal the legislature's desire.
Thank you, Senator.
And Senator Koch, actually, with discussions with the commissioner, I really don't think that first part there is going to upset him too much, because he's kind of a forward-thinking person, and he's got a lot of these people over there looking at all these little things that may add value to our road projects and safety, to the overall highway system. So,
well, I appreciate that.
It's not a real big deal for the commissioner, at least. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, to that point, then I'm not really sure if we have a great commissioner, and I think we have a very good commissioner, that we need to legislate this. I mean, why do we need to codify the instructions about how to manage the agency? We do oversight, but I think we're starting, in several of these places, maybe to head into the place where we are managing the agency instead of providing oversight. And we certainly are adding to the administrative costs of managing the agency. I don't think anybody would argue with that. And with the huge shortage of funds for roads, and other transportation projects, I'm not sure we want to go in that direction of adding layers of administrative expense and burden to our Department of Transportation. I think they're doing a good job, but I don't see how anything in here helps me with the projects I have in my district that aren't funded right now, except to make it harder to get to the funding for Highway 5 or for the intersection at Cherry Street in Waconia, where it has the highest number of traffic deaths in the state. There's nothing in there in this bill that's going to help us with that, and maybe that was never really Senator Dibble's intention. But I think let's stop micromanaging the agency. Let's get them the funding they need to build projects. And I think the commissioner is doing a great job. I don't think that he needs to be told in statutes how to do a good job managing the agency.
Senator Ortman, that sounded like a resounding yes vote for a new gas tax increase. Are you going to carry that next year? No? Well, okay, I didn't think so.
Ms. Chair, I mean, accounting for difference in perspective that I have with Senator Ortman, I do actually think that that this bill would help Senator Ortman understand why a particular project appears on the STIP in a given year and wasn't funded. I mean, it would create, you know, some reporting back mechanism for understanding, because that's what happens now. We have plans that are on the Surface Transportation Improvement Plan, and they don't get funded.
Yeah.
And it kind of happens. It kind of happens year to year. And it, and you know, to understand, you know, and it seems random to us because some stuff does and some stuff keeps getting forwarded. And so to understand for our purposes, as well as the agency being able to gain some understanding in some sort of a methodical, rational fashion, kind of how the STIP is developed and then what happens to the STIP would be useful for everyone. And frankly, the agency doesn't object to the idea of creating within a statutory, you know, creating a statutory platform to stand on, you know, to solidify some of these accountability and these performance measures.
Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, with all due respect, if I have a question about what's happening with the funding, I just ask the commissioner. And constituents from my district invited him out to our district to ask, why isn't Highway 5 being funded? Why is Cherry Street not a priority for this agency? And the answer I got was, and he spent probably the first hour of his presentation to my community telling me that he had new priorities for the agency, that he had a new mission statement, he had a new vision statement, and all new layers of administration. And I'm trying to tell you that I think that we're going in the wrong direction by continuing to add more and more administrative, more and more reporting. Let's just build some roads. If we're going to build, you know, transit, let's build transit. Let's do the real work that the Minnesotans really expect us to get done instead of more busy work, more government, and more administrative regulation.
Well, thank you, Senator Ortman. But, you know, sometimes if we don't do that preliminary work that you call busy work, we build roads that don't need to be built. And, you know, we can look around our system right now, and this is not only in MnDOT. This is in higher education, health and human services. We overbuilt, overpromised, and underdelivered, period. And this is an issue for both parties to accept responsibility for. Senator Ortman, you're complaining about the lack of money inside MnDOT, and yet you continue to resist adding more money to it unless we rob somebody that already doesn't have enough. So, Senator Ortman, great speech, but we've already asked MnDOT on several occasions, and I've been very serious with this, that if it doesn't add value to the bottom line, which is building roads and transportation systems, then we want a direct accountability. The commissioner has given me his word that he's going to bring some suggestions back to maybe clear the deck of some of this stuff that's not needed. Maybe some of the things in Senator Dibble's bill may not be needed. But until we can sit down and talk with the commissioner and start getting these things, and this is not only in transportation that this needs to happen. I mean, all across the state government, if it doesn't add value to the final product, we need to kick it out.
soft studies don't need to happen anymore. There's more things that go on inside of Health and Human Services and education that is a waste of money, flat-out waste of money. Now, in transportation, yeah, we've got a couple studies that are going on that I'd like to see ended, but there are some very useful information. And like I said, we can't afford to build a road that we know we're not going to use in the future. We don't need to repair roads that may be underutilized in the future. Let them turn back to gravel. I mean, we can't afford to continue to do the same things that we have done, unless we have a lot more money.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I liked your speech, too. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, a suggestion. I haven't tried to rework it myself, but the Section 1, rather than adding a hunk of giving serious consideration to, since this is the use of 2% set-aside for research kind of activities, it would be nice to see perhaps that either restructured a bit or to see how the notion of what you're trying to accomplish is addressed in that series, just a part of the whole. It may be an updating of the framework for that whole set-aside rather than just having it look like it's an add-on and we want you to seriously consider it. You know, the use of technology or the cost-effectiveness, some of those terms, you know, have some merit that might be included in that somewhat revised series if someone would take off on that.
Thank you.
Then it isn't kind of a sitting duck outside of
it. Senator Rest.
Thank you. I appreciate Senator Olson's comment and Senator Hooks for bringing up. I do think Section 1 needs to be the language needs to be restructured there so that it's clear that it's part of this 2%. And if you really want them to do those precise things, go ahead and say so rather than he still has the discretion of how to do that within that. But if those are worthwhile things to include within the 2%, just list them outright, I think is what Senator Olson is saying. And it seems to me that what the bill is doing is setting up some ways of communicating that the agency is accountable. And far from being administrivia, too many of our state agencies have shown over and over again with the financial audits that have been done for them, just on that one issue alone, that that they don't consider the reporting and the gathering of information as a demonstration of the accountability for taxpayer funds to be a regular activity that you do without thinking, like brushing your teeth in the morning. I certainly hope nobody here has to make a conscious decision, oh, I guess I better brush my teeth. You just do it. And unfortunately, we have to all too often direct. In this instance, we have to direct the agencies to the level of expectation that we have on information that they give to us that indicates that standards of accountability are being met. And I think reporting to the legislature is a really good way of doing that, and I appreciate your bill. But you need to work on Section 1.
Well, Senator Dibble, I think it's unanimous. Section 1 needs to be worked on.
All right. Thank you. And that's, Mr. Chair, what I hope to hear from the committee before we move forward.
Yep.
I'm ready to move to lay the bill on.
Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1060 as amended be laid on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Members, we've got two more bills to hear, and we have to be out of the room at 2:30, so we got 20 minutes.
Because that's when they had scheduled.
Yes, ma'am.
Is he doing the seatbelt first?
I know.
Did we
do
the
Senate File 2468, Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 2468 is a simple bill. We're going to talk about a little transportation policy here. This is, in effect, remove the seatbelt gag rule that was instituted back in 1963. And basically, back in 1963, our laws were a lot different. A gag rule made sense. At that time, if you were found even 1% negligent of causing your own accident, you could be, all of your claims could be dismissed, just straight out. And people felt that having the seatbelt issue at that time, there was a couple things. One, people didn't think that seatbelts were a needed, they called them accessories back then. And so people weren't as tuned into safety as they are today. 1963 was a different day. Today we have a lot better information. We do know that that seatbelts save lives. And now we have a primary law on the books. And whether or not you agree with the primary law, it is the law of the land, and it's time for the seatbelt gag rule to come off. Members, like I said, the original justification for passing the seatbelt gag rule, they just don't any longer apply. Keeping this on the books won't serve any real purpose. Repealing it will encourage more people to wear their seatbelts. We have a compliance rate now that is 90%+ in the state of Minnesota, and you know, if we can get her up to 95 or 96, that would be a very, very good thing.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Vice President of Prairie Line Incorporated. We're a Shakopee-based interstate motor carrier. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come to you today and discuss the seatbelt gag rule. This is an issue that's not only important to the Trucking Association, but also a wide range of groups. This is an issue not only of fairness and consistency in our laws, but also of safety, and we'll hope you agree and support this bill. When the legislature passed our primary seatbelt law last year, it made a clear policy choice. That choice was to support increased safety on our roadways by requiring all motorists to wear seatbelts. It's well documented by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration and other organizations that seatbelt use has saved thousands of lives. However, because of that choice, we're now faced with a contradiction in our own state laws. Motorists who fail to wear their seatbelts in Minnesota are by definition breaking the law. Yet, if I were to try and offer a valid traffic citation into evidence in court with the intention of proving that someone hadn't worn their seatbelt, the judge would have to deny me. So in one instance, we have criminalized failure to wear a seatbelt, and in another, we're still excluding it completely from the legal process. Reconciling these two provisions is a difficult task. But I put for you today, if you imagine that when you left your house this morning, you knew as you were pulling out of your driveway you were going to be involved in a traffic accident at that moment. Surely, you would buckle up your seatbelt to avoid putting yourself out there to sustain serious injury and would like to avoid as much injury as possible. By doing this, not only would you have obeyed the law, you would have driven responsibly and done everything you possibly could to avoid injury. You would have acted safely and insulated yourself from any claims that your own actions may have somehow contributed to your injuries. As Senator Murphy has said, there was a time and place for the seatbelt gag rule. Today is no longer that time. The law has outlived its purpose and should be repealed. To do so would enhance fairness, consistently, and most importantly, safety. Thank you for allowing me to come here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if time permits.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Senator Murphy. Any further comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that Mr. Carlson is here from the trial lawyers that wanted to make his objection known to the committee. But members, you know how hard we've all worked to try to keep Minnesota roads as safe as reasonably possible, and I think that this is probably this is a bill that we need to move along to Senator Moy's committee so that we can have some of those issues that Mr. Carlson's going to talk about addressed. But
For the policy for the Transportation Committee, this is gold.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, which is an association of consumer attorneys that represent your constituents when they're injured in automobile accidents and through other...
Mr. Carlson, can you be real close to the mic?
And through other means. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, seatbelts are probably the single most important safety device that are installed in vehicles, and we have long supported both their use and their improvement. However, having said that, and my history with this goes back quite a ways, I was a member when we passed the first seatbelt law in 1986, a member of the House, and I voted for it, one of the handful of Republicans to do so. But I have a little bit of difference with Senator Murphy about the history of what the gag rule is all about. The history of the gag rule is that it was brought to the legislatures across the country by automobile manufacturers because they did not want to be held accountable for enhanced injuries when consumers were injured by wearing their seatbelts. And we are thankful that that issue has changed over time. But the underlying issue has remained the same. The use or non-use of a seatbelt or a child restraint system never caused an accident. What is at issue in automobile accidents is who is at fault. And when you or your family are injured through the negligence of an impaired driver or a negligent driver, we believe that it is patently unfair that your damages that you have sustained through someone else's negligence are reduced through no fault of your own. And that is the crux of what this is. We do not believe that there is any evidence across the country that the seatbelt evidentiary rule has anything to do with enhanced seatbelt use. We are in excess of 90% right now in Minnesota on seatbelt use, as Senator Murphy alluded to. It's a very high rate of use, and those that are not using seatbelts, I do not believe are going to be driven to use their seatbelts because of this potentially onerous bill as it relates to your constituents. Okay. And Mr. Chairman and members, you need to also know that this bill and some for Senator Maugh's committee will have a dramatic and negative impact on our courts. In Minnesota, in 2008, which is the most recent report I was able to find, there were almost 80,000 car accidents in Minnesota, and those resulted in almost 34,000 injuries. And of those, many were serious, and I contend that in each of those cases, insurance companies or truckers will raise the issue that you were not wearing your seatbelt, regardless of what caused the accident. And that will serve to reduce your damages. And the reason I say that is that even in according to the public safety, even though 24,000 of those injuries were not fatal or serious injuries, the first thing you do when you're in a non-fatal accident, if you can, is unbuckle your seatbelt and get out of the car. And it is extremely difficult to prove after the fact that you were wearing your seatbelt. And I submit to you, and we will submit to the Judiciary Committee, that issue will arise in every single case. And because it is medical testimony as to whether or not you were wearing your seatbelt, that issue has to be proven through expert testimony in Minnesota. And that expert cost and that expert court time is going to substantially impact the court and consumers. Over almost 200,000 Minnesotans were involved in vehicle accidents. And to say to them that what the damages that they have sustained are going to be transferred to them through no fault of their own, we believe is unfair. The use or non-use of the seatbelt never caused an accident. And lastly, Mr. Chairman and members, you need to know that there are all kinds of evidentiary bars in Minnesota. This isn't like the last issue that the legislature has an evidentiary rule on, and they serve important public purposes. And although this bill doesn't address it, Minnesota Statute 169.94 gets to the truckers issue. You can't introduce a traffic violation in court. This bill doesn't repeal that. You still can't do it. Mm-hmm. We have an important protection for rape victims, a rape shield. That's a legislative protection. We have peer review protection for doctors so that they can find out what happened during medical mistakes. The news media is protected. You can't reveal their sources. We have all kinds of evidentiary protections that serve the public. This bill does nothing but serve those who want to not pay for injuries that they have caused through automobile accidents. That is the only beneficiary of this bill. It will not increase seatbelt use. So as this bill moves forward, and I've talked to Senator Murphy about it many times, look forward to debating these, you know, very important issues, because the benefit to the insurance industry and the lack of benefit to any injured consumer, we think would suggest that the evidence gag rule should stay in place. And lastly, Mr. Chairman and members, the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions do not allow this evidence. I can only find 6 states that allow the evidence in some way. So we are clearly in the mainstream as it relates to this rule. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Murphy, did you have something?
Well, Mr. Chairman, most of the points that Mr. Carlson brings up will be discussed in Senator Waugh's committee. You know, on our committee, we're only worried about the safety on the highway, and that means seatbelt compliance. The other thing that we've talked about in our committee on more than one occasion is, you know, kind of who pays who for what insurance. And, you know, we all have no-fault insurance. We all carry, at least we're all supposed to. And we're all supposed to have, you know, that little portion of uninsured motorists and this, that, and the other. You know, but the bottom line is that everybody's insurance predicated upon how much insurance companies have to pay out. And if we continue to have to, insurance companies continue to have to pay out more and more for people who are injured and not wearing seatbelts, that has something to do with the rates that we all pay. And I think that that's kind of unfair. I mean, you know, if I'm driving down the road and I hit Mr. Carlson and he's not wearing his seatbelt and I was at fault because I rear-ended him, well, then I should have to pay. And that's just the way it is, because my act injured him. But now if we're driving down the road and our cars come into contact side to side and Mr. Carlson gets jacked up and he's not wearing a seatbelt, I'm not responsible for that. I shouldn't have to pay for it. Neither should anybody else. That was Mr. Carlson's decision to break the law and not wear a seatbelt. I know he wears a seatbelt religiously. I'm kind of. But that was his decision, not mine. And besides, you know, sometimes crashes are accidents. I mean, sometimes it is just a freak of nature. But the vast majority of the time, it's because the responsible person, and Mr. Carlson talked about the safety belt being the most safe piece of equipment in the car. That's not true. The most safe piece of equipment behind the car are the two hands that are holding onto the steering wheel. That car is not going anyplace until it's completely safe. Everybody's buckled up. We're going to make right-hand turns appropriately according to the rules of the road. We're going to obey all those semaphores. We're going to be a safe driver. That's the most important thing. Part of that responsibility is clicking that seatbelt. And if you fail to do that, those injuries are kind of on your own. But now, I agree with Mr. Carlson on one point. If he's sitting at a stoplight not wearing a seatbelt and I crash into him from behind, that's not his fault. That's mine, and I should be held responsible. And in that regard, I agree with Mr. Carlson about the gag on who actually was at fault.
Right, that's my point.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Carlson.
Senator Murphy makes a point that I'd like to amplify, and that is that this rule also impacts those who are not required to wear their seatbelt and people who can't buckle themselves up. This also deals with child safety restraints, so now you're going to say that the child who can't buckle themselves up is going to have their damages reduced, who had nothing to do with the accident at all, because their parent didn't buckle them up. And we think that that part of the bill is particularly unfair for those that either aren't required to wear their seatbelt. Senator Scoy, most of the fatalities in Minnesota on our highway, 72% of them are in rural areas. Many farm vehicles either don't have safety belts or they're not required to have them. You're saying if they're involved in an accident right now, the person who caused the accident would not have to pay as much damage because you weren't wearing a seatbelt when you aren't even obligated to pay it. My point is that this does not advance increased seatbelt use. It only reduces damages to those who are injured through no fault of their own. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, and
Senator Murphy.
Senator Carlson, here I'm giving him a demotion. Representative Carlson, former Representative Carlson. Mr. Chairman brings in a lot of things, just like attorneys would, you know. You know, when you're cooking spaghetti and it's getting closer to getting done, you reach in, you grab some, you throw it on the wall. If it sticks, it's done. Sometimes, no offense, but that's what trial lawyers do, is they reach into the pot and they grab every argument they can find and they throw it against the wall. Now, I would hope that if you go in front of a judge had enough common sense to say, Mr. Carlson, you were in an accident. It was Mr. Murphy's fault. Even though you weren't wearing a seatbelt, you wouldn't have been in that accident if Mr. Murphy hadn't plowed into you. Guess what? Mr. Murphy's going to pay for all your damages. I would hope that judges have enough common sense to do that and not to listen to some of this other stuff, like, you know, for those people who aren't required to wear seatbelts, like Senator Scheid's, one of her relatives that delivers papers, you know, that are in and out of the vehicle all the time. I would hope that the judicial system had enough prudence to look at the standard and say, well, these people weren't required to begin with, so... You know, but lawyers can argue anything, and so, but anyway.
Senator Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, I have to say I think there are a few legislators that throw spaghetti once in a while, too. But I'd like to say that I think it's a little misleading to say that if you repeal the gag order, damages are going to be reduced. Because what we're really doing is... Right now, under current law, our judges have their hands tied behind their back. They cannot. They are prohibited from introducing that evidence. And the jurors may not hear it. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard or sat on a jury, but you want to know more. You don't want to be told you can't hear relevant evidence. And our judges are empowered with the rules of evidence in particular to decide that if evidence is prejudicial to one side or the other because it's unfair or it's emotional, something like that, then they have the ability, the discretion, to keep that evidence out of court and out of the hearing of the jury. And so that's what we're really dealing with here. This bill is going to go to the Judiciary Committee, and I'm sure we're going to have a full debate about that. But this is about allowing our judges to do their job to decide what evidence should be submitted for the purposes of the jury and the decisions that they make. And
Senator Gungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I told you in my office when you came to talk to me that you'd have to convince me, and you used exactly the opposite argument what I said in my office, so I'm going to explain that to the members here. Is I was a witness to an accident in which somebody got rear-ended, and the person that rear-ended this car happened to have some level of alcohol but wasn't legally drunk, and he was going through a terrible road construction area where the road construction area had everything to do with the accident, and the people that got hit didn't have their young child secured. The child got killed. And what I just heard from Mr. Carlson is we should reward that kind of stupidity, because I was just angry at what happened in that whole deal, because here's a guy, and he shouldn't have been drinking, but he got hit with vehicular homicide because of a lot of circumstances, but other children were hurt in that car as well, not restrained, and a young child get killed, and that's wrong, and that's what I want to see fixed as well. And I said to Mr. Carlson, there must be some kind of happy medium here, some way to do this, because it's just wrong to be able to pin the whole thing on somebody else and reward the stupidity of parents, because that's what you're doing if they do not restrain their children. I'm sorry, that's stupidity as a parent.
And Mr. Chairman, and
Mr. Carlson,
I don't believe that a lifetime of injuries that are compensated by the person that caused the accident is a reward. I do not view that as a reward. And so we think that it is unfair that those damages to that child who may have a lifetime of injuries and need a lifetime of medical care are reduced because their parent didn't buckle them up, and that is what we believe the result will be from this legislation.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, this committee might be the only chance I have to vote on this issue, so when the motion is made, I request a roll call.
There will be a roll call. Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy. I would move that Senate File 2468 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
Senator Murphy.
There has been a roll call, and the chair votes aye.
Senator Murphy moves Senate File 2468 to be passed and sent to the Judicial Committee. And we'll have a roll call vote.
Senator Murphy.
Aye.
Senator Bonoff.
Aye.
Senator Carlson.
Aye.
Senator Dibble.
Aye.
Senator Dahl.
Aye.
Senator Fischbach.
No.
Senator Gimsey, absent. Senator Jungbauer.
Aye.
Senator Kielash.
Aye.
Senator Koch.
Aye.
Senator Langseth, absent. Senator Moi?
Aye.
Senator Olsen?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Senator Ortman?
Aye.
Senator Perry?
Aye.
Senator Rest?
No.
Senator Saltzman?
Aye.
Senator Sieben?
No.
And Senator Skoy?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. The roll call being 15 ayes and 3 nays. The bill is passed and referred to judicial. We have one more bill, and we are going to hold on that bill until the next committee meeting, which is?
No, we're going to do this bill right now. Yeah.
You want to do it? Okay. Senate File 2540, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2540 is last year's policy bill. It was vetoed last year. The governor sent us a letter. There were four items that the governor objected to. We took them all out of the bill. There was also a couple other provisions that talking with all of our providers, MnDOT, DPS, DVS. There were some dates that needed to be changed. We let staff take care of that. But basically, this is last year's bill, and I've got two amendments that need to occur on this. And the first one is the A1 amendment.
Senator Murphy moves the A1 amendment. To Senate File 2540.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, members, these are technical changes on the A1 amendment.
Everyone have their copy? Senator Murphy moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Amendment is accepted. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, the A3 amendment deals with some language on pages 2 and 3 dealing with rest areas. We had so much fun with rest areas in the past, we decided to take most of this controversial stuff and leave it at the rest area. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A3 amendment. This is going to make it a little more politically palatable.
Senator Murphy moves the A3 amendment to Senate File 2540. Any discussion on the amendment?
Give us just a second. Just give us a sec till we get it.
230.
Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I understand and agree with Senator Murphy's motivation for taking this language out, and I think we've seen the story in the paper about the guy who lives in a rest area in his home, I mean, in a truck. Mm-hmm. And but I can tell you that what this does is means that I never, ever stop at a rest area because they scare me to death. But I understand. But they're very frightening to me. I mean, I go to a gas station. I don't go. I wouldn't pull off in a rest area to use a bathroom for love nor money. Mm-hmm. Not a single person driving by myself. Mm-hmm. Just don't do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I wouldn't disagree with your premise that, you know, and, you know, this is just the way it is. You know,
I
can tell you that if I was a female driving alone, I wouldn't pull over to rest area either.
Never.
You know, there is a lot of activities that happen at our rest areas, and Senator Lori and a few others, I think Senator Olsen and some others tried getting at that here over the past couple of years, and we just haven't been very successful. You know, this part of this rest area issue was, you know, it's perfectly legal to pull into a rest area with a six-pack of beer, crack it open, and have a couple brewskis, and then drive off as long as you're not over the limit. And there's really nothing that you can do about it. And it's state property, and it just
Chairman, Senator Murphy, I support your amendment. I'm just telling you there's more than one side to
Mr. Chair,
what we encounter in rest stops.
Yeah. Senator Olsen.
Part of my other world job, I do drive truck over, not over the road anymore, but, you know, when I drive in Minnesota and stop at the rest area, there is usually an employee there, usually a retired farmer, mm-hmm. and they keep those places so clean, and they watch those places. And I always like to say thank you for keeping this place so clean. Senator Rest, I understand your concerns about some rest areas that that might not be as well, maybe not in Minnesota, but the ones I've seen in Minnesota, I think, are very well maintained. And mm-hmm. and when those guys are there, it's so nice to see that they really take care of that. They have some ownership in that place, and they're picking up every little piece of trash. And you know, I think mm-hmm. people can feel comfortable in those, especially farther away from the metro area.
Ooh, there's a little dig.
Not about
the devil.
Being clean.
I heard that one. Mr. Senator Chairman, Murphy. I'm just going to echo those a little bit. These guys that work for the Greenway folks down at the Lake City rest stop and on down the river to Dresbach, and, you know, they do a fabulous job, but they're not there 24-7. And, you know, like I said earlier, if I was driving along and I was a female, I would go to the 7-Eleven or someplace instead of a rest stop. It's just late at night, there's a few things that go on at rest stops that is not pretty. So, anyway, Mr. Chairman,
Senator
I would move that
Senator Dahl.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, I guess, on this. Then, with this amendment, we have looked at we're going to allow them to pitch tents and sleep overnight outside of a vehicle. I mean, don't you have to have a permit to have that?
They do
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, it's not a state park. You need permits at state parks, but obviously at rest areas, we don't. That was part of that debate that we had, and it just broke down into chaos on the Senate floor because now what's wrong with pulling over and having a beer and then going on my way? Well, duh. You know, and some of this other activity that goes on at the rest area. I mean, Senator Lori really tried to clean that up. And, you know, MnDOT tried to help public safety, and we legislators were kind of the barrier of getting our rest area language cleaned up. So maybe in the future. That's something you can work on next year.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Murphy, then, yeah, well, I guess we'll see if we get overrun by, you know, folks who don't want to pay the permit, and there's 40 pup tents out there, and we'll revisit it then.
Yeah.
Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2540.
We have to move the amendment first. We have not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll renew my motion on the amendment.
Senator Murphy renews his motion on to accept the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Senator Murphy moves Senate File 2540 as amended to be passed.
Finance.
Forwarded to?
Finance. Full finance.
To finance. Any discussion on the bill? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
Good committee.
Thank you, adopted. Mr. Chairman.
How are you?
I'm good.
And that's all the business we have for today. Thank you very much.
We've kind of had an easy February, so starting next week in March, we'll be.